Good morning and welcome to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke, the producer of The Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, WAMC's president and CEO and political observer, Alan Chartok, and Roundtable host Joe Donahue are joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review, we feature your favorite panelists discussing the most important issues of the week. This past Monday, June 28th, Joe and Alan were joined by UAlbany lecturer in Africana Studies Jennifer Burns, political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post, and Albany Law School professor and director of the Immigration Law Clinic, Sarah Rogerson.
The Pope sends more mixed messages on LGBTQ rights. An encouraging note from Pope Francis capped an especially disorienting week on the Vatican's stand toward gay rights. A leader in the Roman Catholic Church's efforts to reach out to the LGBTQ Catholics revealed on Sunday that Pope Francis has sent him a deeply encouraging note, capping an especially disorienting week. On Tuesday, the Vatican confirmed that it had tried to influence the affairs of the Italian state by expressing grave concerns about legislation currently in Parliament that increases protections for LGBTQ people. And days later, the Vatican's second-in-command insisted the church had nothing against gay rights, but was protecting itself from leaving the church's core beliefs open to criminal charges of discrimination. You have to explain that one to me, Libby.
Okay.
Nearly 8 years after Pope Francis famously responded, "Who am I to judge on the issue of gay Catholics?" it has become increasingly difficult to discern where he stands on the issue. A growing dissonance has developed between his inclusive language and the church's actions. So what I take from that as a ever-practicing Catholic is that there's how the Pope feels and there's how the church has treated those in the LGBTQ population who wonder whether the 84-year-old Argentine remains committed to a more tolerant church and is simply struggling to grasp the rapidly shifting contours of a difficult issue, or is it really a social conservative trying just to please everyone? Do you want it this one first?
Sure. You know, this particular Pope, Pope Francis, has been, as we see here, better on LGBTQ issues. He's been more receptive. He sees us as human beings. I think he sees the duplicity in going after LGBTQ people and supporting pedophiles. I mean, you know, it's like he understands, I think, that the church is not in a position to cast aspersions around someone's sexual orientation when they hid pedophiles for so many years who victimized children. And I'm not, and just to be clear, I am in no way equating the LGBTQ community, which is my community, with pedophilia. So let's just be, and that we do not recruit. So let's just be clear about that, because that's a new old trope that the right is using again, that we recruit. And it's like,
I'm sorry, Livy, I know I'm slow, but what do you mean recruit?
Well, you know, the reason why we couldn't have gay teachers was because we were going to recruit the youngins to be gay.
Oh, I see.
Okay. That was one of the tropes from the 60s and 70s, and Anita Bryant. But, you know, the issue here about...
It's fun to hear you say youngins.
Yeah, I know. Believe me.
Go ahead. I know.
But the issue here, most of these kinds of laws around the world, I know at least in this country, exempt religious institutions. And so I would assume that Italy, if they passed this bill adding sexual orientation to a protected class, would exempt religious institutions just like everybody else does. And you know, the Supreme Court a week and a half ago really reaffirmed that when they said it was okay for the Philadelphia Church to discriminate against gay couples in foster care and adoption. So, you know, so I think their argument around this is ridiculous. The idea that the church's core beliefs would be open to criminal charges of discrimination, it has to do with how the bill is written, and I have a feeling that Italy would protect the church and religious freedom, or what they consider to be religious freedom. The real question here is that what's going on in the church, and the fact that you have a more liberal pope, one that a lot of people have not been comfortable with from the get-go, who really wanted to open up the church, who recognizes the fallacies of keeping people out. You know, you have, he wrote this lovely note to this guy who did a workshop on how to bring more LGBT people into the church.
Father Martin.
Yeah, Father Martin. I mean, you know, they recognize that they need to bring folks in because they're losing folks by, you know, the shepherd full, so, or the herd full. So, you know, they just, this church, the Catholic Church and the way it's structured and the hierarchy there, you still have people like Ratzenberger, who was the head.
Ratzenberger, that's wrong. No. You here in Albany?
No.
Ratzenberger.
You know, who was the head of the committee for the propagation of the faith, which is this incredibly conservative faction that basically gives everybody their marching orders. And it definitely is, you know, in conflict with what we see coming from the Pope. And, you know, the Pope comes from that liberation theology of the 60s and 70s that Phil Berrigans of the world, that spoke to so many people about taking care of the poor, making sure people had food and a roof over their heads, and wading into political things when oppression was not what was supposed to be happening. And he's running headlong into a wall. And so, you know, I mean...
And he has problems with the American bishops.
Yeah, right. But the bishops have backed down on their...
Well, because he told them they had to.
Right. But they have backed down on not wanting to give Joe Biden communion. Because I think, look, the majority of Catholics in the United States are pro-choice. And that would just totally, once again, be one more thing to undermine the credibility of the church. So,
Sarah, what do you make of this?
Well, I don't know much about the Italian legal system in terms of how it works and the connection to, I think it's papal law or canonical.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
All that stuff. So, you know, we're looking at I do know a little bit about church organizations and Christian communities, and it's tricky for the Catholic faith bureaucracy because what we do in many Protestant traditions is they just subdivide and say, okay, well, in the Lutheran tradition, for example, there's the Missouri Synod and the ELCA, and there was one other, and then they merged. But essentially, the Missouri Synod is more conservative. The ELCA is more progressive. My father was in seminary during that, when that rift separation occurred. It was very dramatic and messy. And, like, the Catholic Church can't do that because they have a completely different structure. Right? And maybe it's for the best because it forces the Pope to wrestle with these questions as opposed to just breaking off different chunks of the Catholic Church and saying, well, okay, if you feel more comfortable, you know, I was in Brooklyn this weekend and passed by a Presbyterian church that was actually founded in the 19th century by abolitionists. And they had a gay trans flag, you know, a pride trans flag, Black Lives Matter. Then, you know, all of the truly, like, all of you is welcome here and everyone is welcome here symbols and messages, right? Founded by abolitionists. So, like, someone like me could say, oh, I know I want to worship there because, you know, they embrace it, my core beliefs, which I believe are also the beliefs and teachings of Jesus, right? Acceptance and all of that. So, you know, the Catholic Church doesn't have a way to send those signals. Different congregations do. And I know, Joe, you've talked about, you know, different... I'm in a little bit more in the dark and how that works in the Catholic tradition, but it seems to me that they're more restricted in terms of how to signal that to their congregants.
They are, but you find yourself church shopping where you know that there is someone at the helm who is welcome. And sometimes it can be simple as what you just described as a small sticker in the window behind the stained glass that says all are welcome mm-hmm. here. You see members of the church population who are in the LGBTQIA plus community who are running the Sunday school and are running and are working on children's programs, and gay couples who have been married within the church. So you know about that, and in many cases that, you know, that news obviously spreads quickly. And I don't think it's perhaps it's an open secret, but by the same token, you can drive 4 miles away to the next town and the next church that is as conservative mm-hmm. and as what I would term scary. And by the way, I would also say, not to further muddy these waters, but look, it's a lot harder now. You know, you could, quote unquote, church shop a lot easier when there were more priests. Well, now, if you have one priest who is overseeing 8-9 churches in a county, that's really difficult. So, well, they're going on a goodwill tour. I mean, they have so few priests. If you get one at all, you're going to get one who's, you know, on the road. And that's difficult as well. While we are talking about the Pope, we should note, or when we're actually talking about LGBTQ issues during this Pride Month, we'll also note that the Supreme Court has declined to hear a legal battle over the rights of transgender students, handing a victory to Gavin Grimm. You may remember that name. He was the Virginia student who had the Virginia School Board deny him access to the boys' restroom. So the justices now have decided that they will not hear this case, which is then a win for the student. As is its custom, the court did not say why it was rejecting the appeal of the Gloucester County School District. Justices Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito said they would not have accepted the case. The court's decision not to take up the case does not establish a national precedent. In a 2-1 decision last August, the Court of Appeals for the 4th District said the school board had practiced sex-based discrimination and violated the 14th Amendment by prohibiting Grimm, a transgender student, for using the bathroom that aligned with his gender identity. His high school offered a single-stall restroom as an alternative.
The bathroom issue is one of the most divisive, because what you'll get are the crazies on the right saying you're going to have men dress up as women just to be able to go into the women's room and terrorize women and girls. And, you know, it's like, give me a break. You know, we just want to go to the bathroom in peace. And I think that this will be, while it's not national in scope in terms of it, wouldn't make a final decision about it. And given last week's decision, I'm not sure how they would come down on it. But although that was religion and this is just public accommodation, you know, this will have an impact on transgender students throughout the country because their lawyers, if they're told not to use the bathroom, will be able to look at, you know, cite this case and say, no, you're wrong. I mean, we had a situation over the weekend where in New Jersey, of all places, there was a self-identified queer student who was a valedictorian giving their valedictorian speech, and he started talking about LGBTQ issues and mental health, and the principal took the microphone away.
Well, he rumpled up the speech. They cut the mic. Because they said he wasn't giving the speech that they had workshopped with the people. They took it off, they rumpled it up, and they gave him the speech that they approved. And then at that point, he did the other speech by memory.
Right. And this happened a few weeks back at another mm-hmm. high school.
Yeah.
Not about LGBTQ issues, I don't think, but I think about somebody talking about you know, current affairs, and they didn't like what they were hearing. And so, you know, I think this student, well, these students who had the mics taken away from them, you know, have a First Amendment case to bring forth.
You know, it's the fascinating case in New Jersey where the young student was basically shut up and yet finished. Two interesting things about that. One is the response from the student body that was so overwhelmingly right. positive and inclusive. So thank goodness for students. But also, if you look up the principal to see the scandals this guy has had in his past of dealing with the school board and all kinds of issues about people bringing guns to school and terrorist issues and so forth. There have been, I think there's like five different petitions on change.org to try to get rid of this guy. So there's that. But it is interesting that those are the things that will kind of tap you on the shoulder and wake you up. Sarah, anything you would like to add to the Supreme Court decision?
This is why I love serving on a school board. It's like a microcosm of all of the up and coming important issues in our country, you know, diversity, equity, inclusion. That's where a lot of schools are focusing their efforts. The state of New York is asking all New York schools to focus their efforts on diversity, equity, inclusion. And that brings up all of these issues that we've sort of, you know, been, I don't know, I guess schools have always been a place where a lot of these battles are fought. First Amendment protections are really interesting in the school environment. And I guess, you know, on the bathroom issue, of course we should be accommodating trans students. And I'm delighted that the Supreme Court didn't take up the issue in order to issue some sort of nationwide mandate. But that's not something that they would do anyway. They probably, although I haven't read anything, any of the papers, the issue just isn't ripe for Supreme Court review at this point. They're going to need a lot more districts to weigh in, or circuit courts. You know, there's going to need to be a lot of different. I'm not suggesting that people. There's a lot of litigation that needs to happen before the Supreme Court wades into these waters, I guess is what I'll say.
Okay.
And the precursor to all of that will be school board policies, superintendents, principals, and students pushing the envelope.
Alan? But lawyer Sarah, my question to you is, as an individual, as opposed to a lawyer, is where do you come down on letting there be, you know, multi-sex access to bathrooms? You know, this is a major issue everywhere. I would wonder what your personal feelings are on this.
I see it as a human rights issue. Everyone needs to be able to go to the bathroom. And so it's, you know, whatever your community decides, at Albany Law School, we have a gender neutral restroom. And it's easy enough to convert any existing single gender only use. And as many corporations are doing, Target has done it for a long time now. You know, it's not hard to figure out what works in your ecosystem for low cost. Mm-hmm. Eventually, it would be great for us to get to a place where we have private stalls that are, you know, all bathrooms are for all people and all stalls are private. The big issue, and I know this sounds crazy, but I've been in a lot of these conversations in a lot of different spaces, both academic and I've been following the corporate side, is really privacy, and that, like, the way that we've manufactured bathroom stalls leaves gaps. And so, like, it's kind of like a once the manufacturing and replacement of those stalls becomes easier, because privacy is also a universally accepted, like, fundamental right and freedom. So we have to balance all the freedoms and then just get manufacturing to catch up so that it's cost effective to maintain everybody's human rights while also allowing people to go to the bathroom.
Sarah Rogerson on the Roundtable panel on Monday, June 28th. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review, after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. On Tuesday, June 29th, Joe Donahue and Alan Chartok welcomed investigative journalist and New Albany adjunct professor Rosemary Armeo, former EPA regional administrator, visiting professor at Bennington College and president of Beyond Plastics, Judith Enck, and former associate editor of the Times Union, Mike Spain.
Oh, God, Judith, why is it so damn hot?
Sum that up.
Well, it's only going to get worse. I mean, the climate crisis is here, and as bad as it is now, next year and the following will be worse.
So here is my serious question, mm-hmm. I think somewhat serious question, which is we are here in the Northeast going through, it's like, I think my car was like 85 or whatever, but it's very humid outside, and it's just sticky and yucky and all that stuff. But that's normal summer weather for us. We've always had that. That's not terrifically unusual for a late June, early July day. But then you look out west and you see what's happening in Portland.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Pacific.
Cue Mike's T-shirt.
Oh, right.
Western Canada is burning up. 117 degrees, some of the highest temperatures. Just unbelievable. So what do we make of that and put that into a context of that's just not a weather fluke? That is something that is really serious.
Could be religious. Won't be water, but fire next time.
Well, fire will follow because the forests will be so dry, unfortunately. I mean, sadly, this is not surprising. This is what climate scientists have been telling us all along. The hottest years on record have all been in the last 10 years. And heat kills, you know, people who don't have air conditioning, people who have respiratory or heart disease, people who work outdoors. I mean, think of postal workers. And I was just driving over. There's a construction crew working, putting a house
you
up. Yeah, farm workers.
Or the guys on
in the
road.
Field. Yeah.
I know.
I mean, they will suffer with health consequences. So the climate crisis is here. I'm serious when I say enjoy this weather because this is a cool summer compared to what's coming. Our infrastructure's not equipped to deal with it. There have been power outages in the Pacific Northwest. And the question is, are we going to see a proportionate political response from businesses and policymakers? And so far, no.
Or is what happened to Jor-El going to happen here?
Jor-El
was Superman.
Father.
Superman. Yes.
Yeah, and he put the baby in the thing.
And the pod
sent him down. But, and then that world blew up. I always think of Jor-El.
So you
Marlon Brando in that movie, right?
Oh, is that
yeah, 1976. Yeah, it's the hottest since at least 1979 when we look at the temperature and the records that have happened. So I ask this seriously, Judith, but like, so what was happening in 1979 that would have caused that? And so, is it cyclical? And also, by the way, and I don't, I know I'm asking you meteorological mm-hmm. questions, but what's a heat dome?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, well, a heat dome is where the heat concentrates. It's what it sounds like. And you also have the heat island effect in cities.
Yes.
Because there's so much cement. So the temperature will be higher than if you're out in the country. This is a pattern. You know, climate change is not about weather. It's about a pattern in the climate.
Right.
And so, yeah, we had really hot days in the 70s and the 80s. We were having hotter days earlier in the summer. And the hottest years on record since they started keeping track have all been in the last decade. So this is quite serious, and it's exactly what climate scientists told us will happen. And it's not just being uncomfortable. It's putting a real demand on the electricity grid. It's contributing to wildfires, drought. It's cascading.
I want to get to the California drought in just a second. This is a line from a New York Times article on this very subject. Climate is naturally variable, mm-hmm. so periods of high heat are to be expected. But in this episode, scientists see the fingerprints of climate change brought on by human-caused emissions of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases. A Washington State climatologist said that any definitive climate change link could be demonstrated only by a type of analysis called an attribution study.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a safe assumption to blame increasing greenhouse gases for at least some portion of this event. On global average, the world has warmed about 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit since 1900. When you have that warmer baseline, when you get these extreme events, it's just going to get much, much warmer. So then we look at California, just south, because, yes, Portland and Canada are the real, real hot spots, but California is just drying up. And I asked this question because I just finished a novel about the Dust Bowl. I mean, you have to think about that.
Yeah, absolutely. The Lake Mead is the lowest it's been. The sources of drinking water are compromised. Farmers are sacrificing some crops in order to save others. You know, those fields and those farm workers feed the nation. This is extraordinarily serious.
So, what do we do about it?
Well, apropos of nothing, the Republicans, as of today, are still refusing to put climate on the table in an ancillary bill to what the president is asking for that they've agreed to. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, it's Republicans are still in that. They're not really climate deniers. I think they're funded so heavily from the fossil fuel industry that they are unwilling to grasp the reality. What I have a hard time reckoning is these are grandmothers and grandfathers and mothers and fathers in Congress. You know, what do they think their kids' lives are going to be like in, you know, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years?
Right.
But, you know, they put reelection tops. I'm in Albany today, I'm sorry to say, to speak at a demonstration at Congressmember Paul Tonko's office at noontime today because he's introduced a bill that is really bad on climate change and includes federal tax dollars to subsidize garbage incinerators, like the Albany Answers plant that was shut down. What is Paul Tonko doing? So certainly the Democrats are better than the Republicans, but the Democrat response is not sufficient to deal with the crisis at hand.
So let me ask this question, staying on the national level for a second, and that is a headline in the New York Times that said, "Can Biden get a coal state Democrat on board with his climate agenda?" This is about Joe Manchin, of course. So last week, as the president appeared outside the White House to announce that he'd reached a deal with centrist senators on an infrastructure package, oh yeah, by the way, climate change was all the climate money was taken out of that.
Yes.
So how discouraging, but then how do you work around that and get what you need done and, yes, bring Joe Manchin along with you?
Well, I've been thinking about Joe Manchin a lot since yesterday and the day before, because kind of the future of humanity is in his hands. And he would like you to think that, he would like you to think that he's looking out for the working class coal miner. Well, that New York Times article had a really important little tidbit that I was not aware of. Manchin made millions from his involvement in the coal brokerage firm Enner Systems.
Interesting.
Prior to coming into politics, he worked for a coal brokerage firm called Enner Systems, not even a word, which he helped run before entering politics, and which continues to pay him dividends thereafter. Because here's what I would do if I was in Washington with Joe Manchin. I would offer him something like a very large federal facility in West Virginia that will create hundreds, if not thousands, of jobs to replace the lost jobs in the coal industry. It's not that many jobs in West Virginia. And of course, every lost job is serious. But it's not like you're looking to replace a million jobs.
No.
And so, like, let's put a VA data center and do job training in West Virginia. Let's put federal facilities in West Virginia. He can replace those jobs, but I think we now know what's motivating Joe Manchin more than anything, and it's his personal desire for wealth because he's tied at the hip to a coal brokerage firm. So I don't know how Biden is going to get around that.
Yeah, but I think that West Virginia and the Kentucky, the other coal states, are just completely in denial. They don't want to recognize reality. I remember back in 2016, Hillary Clinton was destroyed because she said honestly that the coal jobs are not coming back. And they're not.
Right.
And Donald Trump said, oh, we're going to revitalize the coal industry. And they loved it and they elected him. And of course, that didn't happen. They don't want to hear it. They don't want to be retrained to do something else. I mean, I always thought there ought to be like a Marshall Plan for the coal country. You know, go in, retrain, you know, like you said, you know, some kind of federal spending on a facility that would generate jobs, but also train people, you know, and give them money for education. People don't want to change, and they don't want to. They shrug their shoulders. They're going to look at what's going on in the Pacific Northwest and say, you know, I did read that that kind of thing would ordinarily happen like once every thousands of years,
once
but it's likely to come back and be there
next
summer. Or next week, next summer.
Yeah, this summer. It's only June.
Yeah, you just don't know. And I want to be optimistic, but history and science would urge me to be more cautious.
So to paraphrase you.
Yeah. yes, would you please? Tell me what I'm saying because I don't know.
Well, no, I think what you're saying is quite right. The question is coal in West Virginia like God? In other words, it's a matter of faith, you know. Don't confuse me with the facts. Don't start telling me that we can.
It's a way of life.
It's
a culture, a way of life, and people are frightened about changing it. They want it to be the way it was. They want it to be like it always was in the past, even though many of them died from coal, lung disease, and all that. I mean, it's a terribly unsafe and unhealthy business. I mean, it could be replaced with all kinds of jobs that would be much greener and much healthier.
Rosemary,
do we really know that Manchin wants to undo the climate? Doesn't he just want to decouple it from infrastructure? Biden has made a mess in the minds of Republicans and many Americans about what infrastructure is. They always thought it was roads and bridges, which it definitely needs work. We're seeing that every day in New York State, and no one disagrees on it. So what's wrong with the idea of passing that and then dealing with the next step?
Because
I'm not convinced Manchin's not doing that.
Well, two things. I don't think this is too risky a strategy. I don't think they're going to get to step two. You saw what happened last week when Biden said, well, if you don't do part two, I'm not going to support part one. And then they spent the last 3 days walking that back. Manchin has been consistent. He is very, I mean, he really went after EPA during the Obama administration. He tries to gut clean air standards. He is completely in the pocket of the fossil fuel industry. And the one thing you can say about him is he's been consistently bad on this issue. So he, I believe, is not interested in serious job retraining.
But he's a Democrat, Judith.
Yeah, and he's the only Democrat in West Virginia.
And he's the 51st vote.
Yeah. I don't know what Biden is going to do.
Okay, so look at it. If Biden keeps them all together, he couples everything together, bundles it all together, I should say, Manchin's going to ditch it. So he's saying, if you want any of it, take it apart. That's not a bad political
Manchin's
solution.
Manchin's going to what? Rosemary, I didn't catch that. Manchin's going to what?
Manchin's going to ditch it.
If Biden bundles all of his infrastructure, his initial programs, and climate, and traditional infrastructure.
Right. Manchin is saying, if you want something, take it apart, and I'll give you a vote. I would take that deal.
But
I would too.
But I would not. But to Judith's point, how do you get to? Well, I mean. How do you get to part two? I mean, we've already seen, as you indicated, which I think made a good point. Okay, you look at what the last 3-4 days has been, just over the kerfuffle of walking back with the president.
I've been watching it.
No, I know that.
But here's the thing. No, I get it. But here's the thing. If you don't do it, if he goes, no, I'm sticking with my principles. We need it all. And we do. Then you don't get anything. Just like with gun control. We have nothing. Democrats have stood on, we really need a lot, and we do. We have nothing. So Biden is a centrist. I don't think he's going to do that. I hope he doesn't do that. I would like the roads and bridges fixed.
Okay, but how can we get to the second?
It's plain and simple.
Exactly.
You cannot do it with a razor-thin margin that Manchin or Sinema can blow up in a moment's notice. That's what you need, is voters behind you.
And they don't have them. And by the way, I don't know that McConnell is done yet. In other words, there's an agreement in principle here. but there's an awful lot of shakiness about the whole thing. And I don't know that McConnell won't throw a bomb at the last moment.
Yeah, and he's from Kentucky.
I mean, if you can't trust Mitch McConnell, who can you trust?
Yeah, we're in the soup here. We are in the soup here. I mean, I just don't know in this day and age how you do an infrastructure bill that doesn't address climate change. And if it's not Manchin, as Rosemary says, it's going to be Sinema. If it's not Sinema, John Testa will go rogue. I mean, exactly. it's just unbelievable.
But we need roads. We need bridges. We need mass transit systems. We need pipes that are not lead. I mean, we need all that. If we couple them, we'll probably get none of that.
Not necessarily. I think Biden has to fight harder. I think Schumer has to fight harder. This is the opening act on the infrastructure bill. There's lots of time.
Well, nothing like a good climate conversation on a hot day to bring out a lot of letters. So we will bring them and release them to our panel here. And
then we'll
see
fight about it.
And then you'll all fight about it. And it'll be really good radio. So thank you. All right, here we go. Gregory says, you mentioned climate change and drought regarding the Pacific Northwest, United States, and Canada. You know that there is an issue, yet you omit companies like Nestle, which extracts significant amounts of water from the aquifers, exacerbating drought. You then immediately criticize Republicans for not including climate on aspects of Biden's agenda and claim they are beholden to fossil fuels, as if the Democrats are not. That is some fancy rhetoric to acknowledge the problem and omit capital influences, then focus on government, but only half of the broken two-party system. Take a breath.
Whoa.
Thank you, Gregory.
I'm blaming everyone, Gregory. I mean, the Republicans are terrible in general. The Democrats need to do more. Nestle is indeed tapping into public water sources and then putting out millions of plastic bottles. You have to stay focused. Who's your target that you can influence? And it's certainly, I think, we're going to have a better shot convincing Democrats than Republicans to do the right thing.
Here's a peppy little letter from Bob, who says all of our political problems will pale in comparison to the changes coming. The coastal areas will receive high storm surges. Where it's drying up will get worse. Where it's rainy will get worse. More hurricanes with greater intensities. Hang on to your hats, folks, while the band plays on. Then we go to this letter from Barbara, should we get a new hybrid to replace our 160,000-mile Prius, or is it better for the environment to get an all-electric vehicle? Oh, so climate discussion and shopping tips.
Mm. Yeah, it's better to get an all-electric vehicle, especially if the energy source is clean.
Right, right. You don't want it to be a coal-fired plant that provides the electricity.
Thank you, Heloise.
We do have to do a green Heloise show. I mean, I love the shows when I'm like just screaming and having an emotional breakdown over climate change or plastic in the ocean, and someone writes in and says, number one and two plastic, or is it number three or four plastic? And I appreciate that. And we all have a role to play. Electric, and if you can, mass transit and carpool and bike.
Michael says global warming is a natural cyclical occurrence. Yep, humans are just making it worse. Then we go to Bill. Yesterday's record temp in Portland, Oregon, was something like 118, broke the record that was set the day before.
You know what's amazing about that? That ties the record for the hottest day ever in Las Vegas, which is in the middle of the desert. And right. Portland is a very temperate area, very mild and lovely and rainy.
Sailboats.
Scary.
John says, I left academia after getting my PhD, which was in climate physics. I also always describe climate as follows. Weather, what's happening outside right now. Seasons, the average weather over months. Climate, the average seasons over centuries. Feel free to write this down and reuse it everywhere. P.S. I always ask, are the seasons anything like what they were 20 years ago or when you were a kid? No, that's climate change. Normally takes centuries or millennia to change, not years.
Yes, write that down. Absolutely correct.
Okay, thank you, John. Chas says, the water evaporates from this lake. This is Lake Mead. Becoming useless. Let's breach the dam and let the Colorado River flow freely. All right, free the river. Let's see. We go to...
I'm so depressed. I want to go home and jump in my pool and await Armageddon.
Welcome to my world.
Yeah.
Judith Enck on the Roundtable panel on Tuesday, June 29th. Please note as you listen, any given topics, details, and facts may have changed or evolved since the panels took place live earlier in the week. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable Panel of the Week in Review after this break. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. On Thursday, July 1st, Alan Chartok and Joe Donahue welcomed Albany City Chief Auditor Dorcia Pleers, Edward Hamilton Distinguished Professor of Computer Science at RPI and Faculty Associate of the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University, Fran Berman, and Publisher Emeritus of the Daily Freeman, Ira Fussfeld.
Bill Cosby was released from jail yesterday after a sexual assault conviction is vacated by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. His release was a sudden and shocking turn in a saga of a man who had once been one of America's most beloved entertainers, but who has faced dozens of assault allegations in the past two decades. His conviction in 2018 followed one of the most high-profile trials of the Me Too era. So what happened? Well, in contrast to the tumult that surrounded his trial and conviction, Cosby was released from a state prison in Collegeville, Pennsylvania, shortly after 2:30, with no members of the news media in position yet to record it. I never changed my story or my stance. I have always maintained my innocence, Cosby tweeted Wednesday night. Thank you to all my fans, supporters, and friends who stood by me through this ordeal. Special thanks to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court for upholding the rule of law. So what happened here ultimately is that the Pennsylvania Supreme Court ruled that a prosecutor's decision in 2015 that he would not pursue a criminal case against Cosby prompted Cosby to utter self-incriminating statements at his civil trial, basically admitting to many of the things that the women had alleged that he had done to them. A subsequent prosecutor then used that information to convict him. That, the court ruled, violated Cosby's Fifth Amendment rights. David Wecht, who was the justice, said that Kevin Steele, the current district attorney of Montgomery County, Pennsylvania, was obligated to stand by his predecessor Bruce Castor's promise. And we remember Bruce Castor, yes?
Yes.
Yes, Bruce
Castor.
Very
oily fellow.
Bruce Castor was the gentleman.
I got it.
Yeah, thank you. Castor oil, yeah. He was the one of the defenders of Donald Trump and the second impeachment trial. Very well prepared in that, well, by the way. His promise not to charge Cosby, the court deemed Steele's violation so, quote-unquote, vast that it ruled his office may not put Cosby on trial for those charges again. So as it stands, at least to my knowledge, at this moment, he cannot be returned to jail unless one of two things happen. The Supreme Court of the United States overturns the decision, which has rarely have ever been done, so there's no chance in hell that's going to happen, and or that you would have another victim who would be within the statute of limitations. And we will remember the woman who actually brought this case was, I think, within 5 or 6 days of it expiring as far as the statute of limitations. So that would obviously have to all happen. Let us not forget two things, and then we'll welcome you all into this conversation. One is that 60 women have accused Bill Cosby of drugging and sexually assaulting them. 60 women. 5 went on the stand in this trial in Pennsylvania. He has served 2 years in jail of a 10-year sentence. This, we should note, and it's probably a small consolation, this, him getting out of prison, by no way means that he did not commit these crimes, nor that he was not guilty of them, but basically got out on this technicality because he was promised one thing and the court did another.
And Joe, if I remember this correctly, he actually had this drugging stuff in his comedy routine. He actually talked about it.
He did.
Yeah, so...
I don't remember that. Yeah, say more.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's what I remember. I remember that as part of his comedy routine, and Joe will remember more than I do.
He would talk about... Yeah. He would talk about... I mean, it probably meant more later than it did at the time, but it was basically about you slip something into the drink and then you know have an easier date and that kind of stuff. And I think it was fairly accepted at the time, and yet when you look back on it, it was just really creepy.
Okay, let me unbulge my eyes at this point.
Okay.
Wow.
Okay. And it goes back, I think that particular routine goes back many, many years, but so do the allegations, of course. Who would like to comment on what happened to Mr. Cosby yesterday?
Ryan.
I am not going to surprise you. Let's just put it that way. I mean, I can imagine that for the victims and many other people, this is just devastating stuff. The Me Too movement was a long time in coming, and it's still here. It just shouldn't be okay for some people to go to work and get to do their job in an environment where their gender doesn't matter, and for other people to go to work or to deal with other people in their job and have their gender matter and have it somehow create a really tough environment. It just shouldn't be okay. And the Me Too movement has come for a long time. You know, for me, and you know I'm your cheery person on the panel, I'm always trying to look for a silver lining. I think we are making slight progress, because the really important part of the Me Too movement isn't just the really high-profile individuals, the Cosbys and the Weinsteins and, you know, the Epsteins and, you know, all those folks. The really important part is the institutional stuff, because there is a lot of institutional harassment. There is a lot of institutional problems for women. And you're seeing, and it's glacial, and it's small, but you are seeing more attention to those kinds of issues.
We say this often, and Dorsey, I want to get to you, but we say this often when we're talking about powerful white men who are able to do something that no one else is able to do, i.e. get out of prison. And yet here you have one of the richest men in the world who was able to do this, and you wonder, well, how level is that playing field? Would anyone else who had been convicted of that crime been able to get out and have it overturned by the judge and by the court?
Well, but wealth and stature makes a difference. I mean, look at Martha Stewart. How did she spend her jail time?
Yeah.
So, you know.
And is still back on the air, being quite famous right now.
Absolutely.
You bet. And I have nothing against Martha Stewart, but I just want to say, if you have stature in this society and you have the money to try to figure out where those sort of tiny little loopholes are, these good things can happen to you, and that's really discouraging.
Dorsey.
Yeah, surprisingly, this was very quiet, especially given all of the noise surrounding the case and the conviction, and it was just a whisper. I think people are waking up to, oh my gosh, Bill Cosby is home free. But, you know, this prompted me, and I'm going to go there, this prompted me to think about the most recent Chauvin sentencing.
Right.
Because the judge made a point to say in his remarks, this was about following the rule of law, and the sentencing was based on the rule of law and fairness based on that. And so this is the same, and granted, I was so disappointed hearing
the results of that, the sentencing.
22 and a half years, he could have received up to 40. So basically half the time.
For the death of a human being.
Yeah, the murder of a human being,
exactly.
Right.
And so this essentially reminded me of that, this notion that just purely looking at the law, his Fifth Amendment right was violated, and so this is the grounds for the conviction being vacated. And so, again, I throw my hands up, confused, when we talk about the fairness of our legal system. I am very perplexed by it. And so nobody wins in this case. Bill Cosby, his family, this has been, I'm sure, very devastating to his wife, his kids. His reputation has been forever tarnished. I think, you know, for the black community, you know, culturally, that the Cosby family challenged so many norms and stereotypes when it came to what it meant to be a black family in this country. And so this has been a huge loss for everyone, and including the victims,
right,
who feel, why come forward
right,
when no one will hear me?
And you wonder,
or believe me.
Right, and of course now, why do I come forward if they're just going to let the guy out after a couple of years? Right. I know I'm with Fran in this. When she's here, I pick up her vibes. So I'm going to ask a very kind of Pollyannish question, perhaps. Aww. But let me ask this: at any point, do you think the court looked at each other and said, "What impact will this have on the victims? What impact will this have on this movement moving forward? What impact will this have on the 60 women who have made these charges?"
You know, it's hard to say. You know, that depends on the makeup of the decision makers, because as we know, this is the thoughts and the desires, the needs of the victims are almost never top of the mind for folks who don't have the lived experience, who can't empathize. And so it really depends on, you know, who was sitting around the table making that decision. And I think the other piece here, some pride themselves on, you know, we are making a decision purely based on fact and law. And so
right,
all of these outside perspectives, we can't factor that in when making a decision. So it's hard to say.
Yeah.
But you make such a good point, Doris, because the law books are filled with particular laws and these are the rules. But we all know that depending on the personalities or character of the judges, they can reach down and find what they want within the available resources of the law. So I think your point is well taken when you say depending on who is sitting around the table, because, you'd have to do psychoanalysis on the judges in order to figure out where they're
coming. I don't think we want our judges to be making decisions on reasons other than the law. I mean, to Joe's question, I don't know whether they sat around and made this decision with the impact that you described on their minds, but I don't think they should have. Go ahead.
No, I agree with you, but the other way of asking the question is,
I don't.
Well, I mean, you do want your judges to look at the law and to interpret what is put in front of them. So I understand that, although I would also argue that in this case that's questionable because the deal that they're talking about was never in writing. It was a verbal agreement. Regardless, but at what point when you say that, do you look at the case itself and the person getting out, and if it was anybody else other than Bill Cosby, would the same, would the same thing been achieved?
So here's a comment about the law. When I was at Harvard on sabbatical as a Radcliffe Fellow, another one of the Radcliffe Fellows.
Okay, that was the coolest statement ever made on
radio.
Oh
my gosh.
No, this, dropping.
This just gives you context for the person I'm going to talk about. And
it's Warren Beatty. Go ahead. No.
Another fellow was Alexi Lahav, who is a law professor at University of Connecticut, and just incredibly smart. And I learned so much from talking to her about the law, and so much of what we see, you know, for me as a tech person, I tend to think of the law as monolithic, which is not true at all. You know, it is contextual. It is up
exactly.
to... the judge's temperament, their discretion,
the
facts of the case. The laws are not always consistent. The laws, you know, what counts as evidence isn't always the same. And so these things are very contextual. And one of the things we had been talking about in the break that I'll just repeat here is it does seem that if you're rich and you're famous and you have the resources, then you can find a lawyer who really knows how to take that system and put it to your advantage. For everybody else, not so much.
No. There's something else here. He immediately puts out a statement saying, see, I wasn't guilty.
Yeah.
I've always contended.
Which is not what this said.
I've always contended I wasn't guilty. No, he dropped the stuff in the ladies' drinks and or the women's, sorry, better term, in drinks. and you know what the result was. So he was guilty.
He admitted that in the civil case,
wasn't that the issue here?
Yes,
he admitted it in the civil case, but he was
but they told him they would not charge
they would
him.
Not charge him. Listen,
which is really messed up in and of itself.
Yes. Well, look, I obviously am not a lawyer. I don't know flat out that this is the right decision. Although I must say, I watched an interview. You may have seen it last night with one of Cosby's lawyers. With Chris Cuomo, and I thought she was very good in explaining their side. But moreover, I was expecting to see a knockdown dragout with Cuomo, and he largely agreed with her on the law. So if we and I think someone said earlier that this all happened quietly. The lawyer would say that the media did not pay attention to this issue, which was brought up apparently more than once during the course of these proceedings. So I would say to you the following: if this was the law and he was able to get off as a result of the law, we can call it a technicality, which it is. On the other hand, it is an important technicality. That said. The court of public opinion is clearly not on Cosby's side. His reputation, rightly so, has been ruined. His legacy has been ruined. And I would say the concern that I would have going forward is not that Cosby didn't serve more time at his age and standard in life, but that this will somehow prevent women from stepping forward.
Absolutely.
And that's a key issue at this point. Mm. And I would hope not.
Ira Fussfeld on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, July 1st. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable. You may contact us by emailing roundtable@wamc.org. The Roundtable panel will not convene this coming Monday, July 5th, in observation of Independence Day. We'll be back on Tuesday. This has been this week's Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. Thank you for listening.